Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, February 4th, 2021. This is our third of three oral cases for today's calendar. This is case number A20-0719, Christy Ray Pollock versus Stephen Vincent Pollock. Each counsel will have 15 minutes for initial arguments, followed by 5 minutes for rebuttal. Just a few items of housekeeping. First of all, thank you both very much for joining us via zoom.gov and holding these arguments orally, or I should say virtually rather than in person, which we'd prefer, but we certainly appreciate you accommodating us in this way. If there are any issues that come up at all during the oral arguments, we will make sure that we make appropriate accommodations. Also, this is being recorded. No other recordings, either audio or video, are allowed beyond what we are doing here. And with that, I believe those are the only other items that we need to discuss. Counsel, for appellant, when you are ready, you may proceed and please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Susan Dodlin of the law firm Henschel Moberg, and I represent the appellant, Christy Pavlock, who is the mother of the party's two children. We are here today asking the court to reverse the district court's denial of mother's motion to modify child support. The lower court failed to properly determine father's gross income from all sources, including his self-employment income as a 20% owner of two family-owned business entities, as is required under Minnesota Statutes 518A.30 and under the Supreme Court's holding in the Haefeli case. Because it didn't determine father's total gross income, the court did not correctly determine the presumptive child support obligation under the guidelines. And as a result, it concluded that mother had not met her burden of proving the current support order was 20% and $75 different than the prior order. But under the proper application of the statutes and Haefeli, mother did show that father's guideline support obligation would be high enough to trigger the modification presumption. It should have then become father's obligation to prove, if he could, that a downward deviation is appropriate under mitigation factors.
Ms. Donlin, yes. I want to ask a question, but for some reason I don't see respondent counsel on my screen.
I think he disappeared.
That's one of those technical issues I had warned about. We will stop the clock and we will, thank you.
I have a question. So when the start clock starts again, I have a question.
So we will pause so we can get Ms. Brown back on.
Thank you.
And I'm not quite sure where, when we lost Mr. Brown, Judge Borky, you did notice that right away. Why don't we put, Marshall, if you could put 14 minutes back on the clock just to make sure that we have enough time so that he can hear.
He's in the waiting room. I see he's in the waiting room.
Good morning again, everybody. My apologies. I don't know if that was on my end or not. I'm reconnected. I don't know what happened. My Wi-Fi has been working the whole time, so I apologize.
Not a problem. And that's exactly why I said earlier that if we do run into any technical issues at all, we'll certainly accommodate. We did reset the clock for 14 minutes. I'm not sure exactly where you dropped off, but I'm going to give Ms. Dudlin the opportunity to go back to the last portion she was talking about to make sure that you can hear it, Mr. Brown. And then I know that Judge Warkey had a follow-up question to that as well.
Very good, thank you.
Okay, you bet. Ms. Dudlin, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I had summarized just the beginning portion of our case. And it had just stated, I think, that because the district court hadn't determined father's total gross income from all sources, it didn't correctly determine the presumptive child support obligation under the guidelines.
That's where I interrupted with this great question, Mr. Brown, that you missed. No, I really didn't say anything yet, but this is what I wanted to ask. And Ms. Donlin, this is probably a question more for Mr. Brown, because if the gross income is determined, the district court can downward deviate, can't it? And end up right where you're at? I mean, to me, it seems like a lot of times we get into this rat maze and we go around and around and around, because there is a $1,500 downward deviation. And that's what father's counsel is arguing, that you could end up in the same place. Is it true that could happen?
It is correct that after the district court makes a finding as to what the party's total gross incomes are, yes, and determines what the presumptive child support amount would be, then in appropriate cases, it can go through the deviation factors and decide whether there are valid reasons to support a downward deviation and why that deviation would serve the children's best interests.
So then what the real nugget is you want to find out what he is getting from the closely held business. I mean, that's the whole gist of this thing, is to find out about the business earnings. That's a question, not a statement.
Correct. And we did provide the district court with a wealth of information including business and personal income tax returns of Mr. Pavlak and of the businesses that he is co-owner of with his family. And based on all of that very voluminous information, provided the district court with references to the record to show that Mr. Pavlak's total monthly gross income from all sources is $30,146 per month.
All right, you did, with all that information, you got a lot of stuff you gave to the district court. You made a projection based on your interpretation of that data as to what the gross monthly income is. Is that a correct statement?
That's correct.
Okay, yep. And in response to that, there was no competing gross income statement. It was rather an argument that this is a downward deviation?
It's a little murky. I will say that that father did not dispute mother's calculations arriving at the $30,000 a month. He didn't put any other competing calculation of what his gross income from all sources would have been. He stood on his position that only the W-2 wages should be considered as father's income.
That's a legal argument under Hathley. So then in terms of what you're asking, if we agree with you and we send it back to district court, are you asking that the record be opened, or are you asking that we indicate that this is income that should have been counted in determining gross income? I mean, what do you want? That's what I'm getting at.
Certainly the instruction should be clear that all of the income is to be taken into account when determining what his gross income is.
But if he had an opportunity to provide that already, can the court make its decision based on what is already in front of it? And I can't remember the judge.
It's Judge Brown.
Mr. Brown. That's very interesting.
That's right.
talking about Judge Brown, does Judge Brown have enough information at this point? Or are you going to go back and we're going to have all the information presented again? And competing information as to what is the business income?
Well, he does have all the basic gross income information. There is information that we would have liked to have had available to us that was not provided in discovery. There was a whole other skirmish over whether discovery was sufficiently provided or not. We did not know precisely the amount that had been actually distributed to Mr. Pavlak in the relevant period of years that we were looking at. So we had the overall gross income of the business available to us. And from that, we just derived what the total.
So if it's fair to say, then you could win at the appellate court. It could go back to district court. You'd have a lot more activity, yourself and Mr. Brown, and you could end up with the very same result, except your outstanding request for attorney's fees on appeal.
I don't.
It's just a gross generalization, but that could be what happens, right? Which is why you hope people settle their differences.
Yes, and we gave that a shot. That was not successful, and I don't see how. I don't know that under a correct interpretation of gross income as defined by the statute and as directed under Haefeli, this case could possibly support a downward deviation under the facts of these people's financial circumstances. You've got a mother whose only income is from disability. She has disability income of about $1,300 a month for herself, and she gets about another $700 something for the children.
Would agree with you and send it back again to Judge Brown for more consideration, do you think it advisable that we indicate or not indicate to Judge Brown that, I mean, is Judge Brown in a position where he can entertain a motion to downward deviate, or is that something we should just leave alone?
I would ask the court to offer its opinion that this is not a case for a downward deviation.
But Mr. Donnellan, isn't that really
clear? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, but isn't that really an issue for the district court to determine? And look at the factors as to whether or not a deviation would be appropriate or not. I mean, I hear your argument as to why it shouldn't, but isn't that an argument that is best made to the district court, where both parties have an opportunity to argue all the factors, including the best interests of the children factor?
Well, yes, it probably is, Your Honor. This is not a fact-finding court. Certainly, I understand that. I note that Mr. Brown, in his respondent's brief, suggests that this court should just assume, if it sends the case back down, that the district court would make all the appropriate findings in his client's favor under the deviation factors. And I would submit that is not an appropriate assumption for this court to make. So all things being equal, the law being applied to both of us equally, yes, the district court is in the position best suited to make findings about whether deviation is appropriate in this case and is in the children's best interests.
Okay, I have a follow-up question to something you had mentioned, and this is, let's assume for the sake of argument, following Judge Warkey's analysis, let's assume for the sake of argument that you're asking for a reversal and remand, and you, in terms of opening up the record, you had mentioned that you would ask for information and wanted to get more information in terms of distributions. I just want to clarify. So what you're talking about are distributions where Mr. Pollack would actual cash distributions to him that he may have received, is that the issue there?
To the extent Mr. Pavlak is arguing or would be arguing for a deviation because the total gross income from the businesses is something that isn't available to him, which is, one of the factor that the Haefeli court references in saying, what a lower court should or could analyze in deciding whether to deviate is whether all of the income from the business is available to the owner. If Mr. Pavlak's going to argue that it's not, then we need to know, well, how much cash has been distributed to him in the years that we were examining before this motion took place. That information was not provided. There was one affidavit from Mr. Pavlak's sister, who another owner of the business, who said that it was a two-page affidavit that just sort of conclusorily said that the business doesn't pay distributions except for these few very minor amounts they paid for the sale of scrap metal. Oh, and the amounts they need to pay their federal and each owner needs to pay corporate or to pay federal and state income taxes on the corporate income attributed to them. Well, we never were provided with how much Mr. Pavlok received for the scrap iron distributions and his federal and state income tax obligations. And I believe that in the record, there was some suggestion that Mr. Pavlok did receive distributions roughly double what his actual tax obligation was for, I think, 2017. So it's not clear what he receives, what's been made available to him, what he would have available to pay child support, what benefit he receives from the company retaining corporate income rather than distributing to partners. It's clear that his position is that if the business retains its earnings and doesn't distribute them to the owners, that he benefits from that by acquiring a greater interest in the business, or you know, the business grows in value and it accrues a benefit to him. We don't know the ins and outs of that, and so if he were to argue that he shouldn't have to pay presumptive guideline child support, we need to know what benefit he's getting from the business retaining his share of the income.
So just to clarify, bottom line, what is your ask of this court in terms of reversal, remand? Are you asking this court to instruct the district court to open up the record to determine that issue, or to decide that issue?
We want this court to reverse the denial of the child support modification, to remand for appropriate findings under the statute of what his gross income is, under the statute and hayfully, and to the extent the district court deems appropriate, to reopen the record and compel Mr. Pavlok to respond and to provide the information previously requested but not provided in discovery. We didn't appeal the denial of the motion to compel, but that would be what I would ask as sort of a natural function of a remand.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think our position is pretty clear. I just want to make it very clear for today's purposes that in both his brief before this court and in memoranda filed at the district court level, the respondent agrees that the lower court should have made gross income findings on all of Mr. Pavlok's income, including the income from the corporation. That's kind of the starting point the district court was supposed to use, rather than just saying Mr. Pavlok's income is his W-2s and all the other income isn't available to him. He doesn't control the distributions. He doesn't get to decide whether the business retains its earnings. So I'm not going to attribute any of that to him. And so that means that his child support doesn't change. So that's kind of backwards. Mr. Brown and his client have never disputed and in fact agreed that the starting point for the district court was supposed to be the gross income from all sources, which we submit is about $30,000 per year. And as I said earlier today, Mr. Pavlok also did not provide any alternative analysis of his total gross income from all sources to compete with the $30,000. So for purposes of this proceeding, the record before the court that hasn't been disputed in any way, despite more than a year of litigation about this and three different hearings, I believe, Mr. Pavlok never disputed that amount.
Thank you, Ms. Sutherland, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may begin. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
It please the court, my name is Jason Brown, and I represent the respondent, Stephen Pavlok, in this case. The relief that Mr. Pavlok seeks is to have this court uphold or affirm the order of Judge Brown at the district court level. From our perspective, there are three crucial issues for the court to consider in this case. First, did the district court consider the 518.43 deviation factors in its order? Second, did the district court make substantially sufficient findings? And third, did the court abuse its discretion in denying appellant's request to modify child support? We do believe that the court did consider the deviation factors. We do believe that the findings are substantially sufficient.
Well, I'm not troubled, Mr. Brown, with the deviation factors. I mean, a court is certainly empowered to do that, but don't you first have to conduct a gross income analysis before you deviate? You say, here's what wife makes, here's what husband makes. Now I think a deviation is important. We don't have your client's income.
Well, I would dispute the notion that we don't have his income. The information that was provided to the district court was comprehensive. And it was, as counsel alluded to, essentially agreed to. Our issue in this case is not how much they're alleging his income is when you take into account the combination of his salary and his corporate distributions or his share of corporate distributions. The issue here is, from our perspective, is that income actually available to Mr. Pavlak? And the word available is the common thread between the Haefeli decision and the Paddock decision. And so we're not here to suggest for one moment that there's been an inaccurate recitation of what the corporate distributions are. We're here to suggest that in light of the Grime case, even though the court perhaps should have more clearly analyzed in sort of a lockstep manner the 518A.43 factors, simply because the court didn't provide that in written analysis lockstep, it's not detrimental.
But you didn't argue Pavlak at the district court level, or did you? And I missed it.
We did, Your Honor. Yes, we repeatedly argued the Paddock decision, and informed the court, in fact, how factually similar the Paddock decision is, and how applicable
but
it is.
If that is the case, then the court needed to make written findings on that. Wouldn't that be right if you're relying on Paddock? If that was, if you argued that to the district court, and I'm assuming you did, then we should have had the findings in the court order. And that's what's missing.
Well, the issue in Paddock, and I'm answering your question, Your Honor, the issue in Paddock was, you know, were the findings sufficient when the district court in Paddock didn't provide an express set of findings over all six or seven of the 4-3 deviation factors. In other words, the wife in Paddock argued, just as wife in this case, that, hey, the district court didn't expressly analyze all of these deviation factors, so kick it back. But what this court held in Paddock is that the focal point of the Paddock court was whether or not income was actually available to the obligor. And I would submit, Your Honor, that in this case, there were findings made by Judge Brown regarding the availability of income.
So what did the district court find in terms of the availability of the income?
The district court in our case found that the gross income of each party was, as outlined in finding 52 and 54 of the court's order. What the court did was suggest that it was W-2 income. And I'm not suggesting for one moment that it's only W-2 income technically as a definition of his gross income. But what the court here said is, in balancing that first deviation factor, that wife has income of $2,042 a month, that's finding 54. Finding 52 is that father has gross monthly, it's his salary of $8,423. Finding 53 says that appellant argued to the court that because of ownership interest, his gross monthly should be the $30,000 that they are arguing. But the district court, in an exercise of discretion under Haefele and Paddock, specifically stated that he's not a corporate officer, he can't make financial decisions, he doesn't control distributions. And so therefore—
But also under Haefele, distributions aren't the correct method for determining income from a joint ownership. So doesn't the court also need to step aside from looking at distributions?
I think it's ultimately at the end of the day, I think it's about looking at what is Mr. Pavlak's share of the profits at the end of the year. And profits, I think to most people, myself included, would involve how much money do you make? You ask someone on the street, how profitable is your business? You know, it makes $200,000 a year in profits. That doesn't mean that that person takes home $200,000 extra dollars. They have to pay income tax on those profits. And that's what happened in this case. And in many cases, people will reinvest those profits back in the business. That's what happened in this case as well. They're still taxed on it. It's still noted as income on the K-1. But it comes down to, again, that core question of A, whether it's a legitimate use of your income, your profits to reinvest, and B, whether that income is actually available to you. And in this case, unlike in Paddock, where Mr. Paddock was a sole proprietor with sole authority over his money, the corporate money within his woodworking business, the Court of Appeals in that case said, yes, that's a legitimate use. He can decide how to reinvest his money in the business. Here we have Mr. Pavlak, who is not in the chain of command at the corporation. He's a minority shareholder with no decision-making authority. I think it logically flows that if the court in the Paddock case would defer to and allow for a downward deviation for someone with complete control over the corporate money, that would be appropriate, as in this case, to permit a downward deviation in someone who has no control over corporate funds.
But Mr. Brown, your analysis overlooks Haefele. That issue came up in Haefele. And here it seems like the district court made an error in the initial analysis of determining what father's gross income is. And you're referring to what person on the street. Well, we don't care about a person on the street, to be blunt. And this, we have to look at what the law says, how his income has to be determined. And it's my understanding that you don't dispute the fact that the district court did not do that analysis. But I think the way I read your brief, your analysis is, it doesn't matter. We don't have to reverse and remand because the district court is going to reach the same decision anyway. But I want to start with the first part. You don't dispute that the district court erred in its analysis of gross income, correct?
I do. I mean, I find myself in a challenging position of having to criticize and suggest that perhaps the district court didn't conduct the analysis that should have been done. But the second part of the argument, and I tried my best in the motion for amended findings to sort of hint at that by suggesting that, well, the court does have the power to enhance its findings if it really wants to. And so maybe the court ought to do that. The court opted not to do that. But my point is that the fact that that wasn't done, you can then turn to the Grind decision. And it's actually in the Paddock decision too, because Paddock didn't analyze every factor with precision. If the findings are substantially sufficient, then on logic and the facts and the record, this court need not reverse.
Because right, but really what you're asking us, sorry, Mr. Brown, what you're asking us to do is to cobble together based on the record before us to fill in the blanks of what the district court, I certainly understand your position of being in an awkward position of trying to steer the district court in an appropriate way. But we're an error correcting court. We're an appellate court. We can do that. And quite frankly, when I look at the record, it seems like the district court's logic was, with all due respect, flawed, because it said, I'm not going to look at anything other than, his income that the district court determined. I'm not going to look beyond that because he's not a corporate officer and therefore does not have any financial decisions or ability to make or control corporate distributions. But that's not the test. The test is to look at all of the income, what regardless of whether it's actually put in his pocket or whether it's put back into the corporation, that's still imputed to him under that first step. And if that first step is analysis is erroneous, it seems like we have to reverse, not to mention the fact that the deviation factors, there's no analysis and there hasn't been an opportunity for both sides to argue the merits one way or the other.
A couple of thoughts in response, Your Honor. First, I don't think that pursuant to Grine, it is an absolute that this court reverse and remand. I think the outcome is fairly obvious. The court was asked to make amended findings using the same arguments that Ms. Pavlak is using on appeal. And the court found that there was no basis to do that. Now, maybe that was an error, right? Because the analysis didn't logically follow the statute. But the court in Grine found that the district court didn't logically lockstep follow the custody modification statute. In Grine, the court was supposed to have analyzed four crucial factors, and the court only analyzed two of them. But what this court held was that, actually the Supreme Court held, that on the files, the record, as well as the findings taken in total, if it is obvious that the same findings are going to result on remand, that as a matter of judicial economy, this court need not reverse. And that goes back to the, I think the initial point that Judge Work had raised about this being a rat maze. that's what this feels like. I mean, we've come in and not disputed any of the factual allegations about incomes or anything along those lines. What the court has had in front of it is a less than 2-year-old divorce decree that breaks down each and every 518.43 deviation factor. None of those were in dispute at the time of this motion. And what I mean is—
Right, but Mr. Brown, let me stop you there, because when you're referring to that during the dissolution, what we need here is an analysis of those deviation factors at this stage, now that the issue had been raised to the district court that, no, there is a change in income here. In fact, if you look at all the distributions to husband. And so, again, it feels like we would have to cobble together not only the district court's analysis here, but what the district court's analysis was in the underlying dissolution decree. And I'm not sure we can do that. It seems that we need to allow the district court the opportunity to do the proper statutory analysis and case law analysis.
With that, Your Honor, I would suggest that none of the other factors that are in 518A.43 were disputed or even addressed by Ms. Pavlak at the district court level. For example, there was no pleading, no allegation raised factually by Ms. Pavlak that said that the standard of living between the two of us cannot be maintained. There was no allegation raised by her factually about the dependency exemptions. The decree says each party gets one. There was no allegation by Ms. Pavlak that someone was going to relocate out of state. There was no allegation about the statutory minimums. The nut in this case is factor one, the resources that are available to each party. And in this case, I would respectfully submit that the district court maybe didn't make perfect findings, but I think made adequate findings, because that was the only real disputed issue before the court. None of those other 518A.43 factors were brought to the attention of the court, because there's no dispute about them. There's no analysis to be had, because no one has said that anything has changed in the 20 or so months between the entry of the decree and the time that Ms. Pavlak made her motion. So we believe, Your Honor, that this is a case where the court can affirm. It sequentially follows a Haefeli to Paddock to Grine analysis. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Dolan, you'll have the last word for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. For all of Mr. Brown's reliance on the Paddock case, his non-precedential case cited in his submissions, I've got the Steer versus Peterson case in which the court there affirmed a district court attributing all of a business owner's income to him for purposes of child support, even though the company was not distributing the income to him and was retaining it. And the district court in that case conducted an appropriate analysis of the father's income under Haefeli and the statute. And so this court affirmed. In Paddock, likewise, the district court in that case did the appropriate analysis under the statute and under Haefeli and came to a different result. This court affirmed. The key is that the district court is required to do the analysis, and the district court here did not even come close to doing the analysis that the statute and Haefeli requires. As far as deviation, Your Honor, I cannot make it more clear that this is not an appropriate case for deviation. The district court did not voice any intent in any finding, even though invited to by Mr. Brown, did not state that this is a case where father's presumptive child support obligation under the guidelines is too high and he shouldn't have to pay that much. I'm going to reduce it because reducing it is valid for reasons and is in the best interest of the children. The order here doesn't say anything like that. The mom in this case makes $2,000 a month in disability income. Mr. Pavlak, setting aside the total of $30,000 a month that we've calculated, even the district court's findings show that he makes $8,400 per month in W-2 income. The father makes more than four times the income mother makes, even in that case where all of the other corporate income is disregarded. The purpose, as stated in the statute of the deviation statute, is to prevent a parent and the children from living in poverty. Well, Ms. Pavlak's income of $2,042 per month, I looked it up today, this is public record, is just about $200 over the federal poverty guidelines. Mr. Pavlak is not living anywhere near the federal poverty guidelines. Mr. Pavlak cannot articulate a reason why he should not pay guideline child support and is entitled to a downward deviation. I would ask that if this court grants our request to remand this proceeding, that the purpose of the deviation factors be made clear in its opinion. This is a case that was mishandled from the beginning, was misanalyzed by the district court, and even when given a second chance to correct its findings and do the analysis properly, it simply chose not to. It did not amend its original findings in any way. It did not say, you know, I've considered all of this additional argument about the cases and the statutes, and here's why I'm not going to make a change. I think this court understands that the district court failed to make the analysis it was required to do. It needs to be reversed and remanded for proper findings to be made and for the appropriate guideline child support amount to be considered and in our position applied in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments and briefing by both parties. We appreciate it. We will be issuing an order within the statutory timeframe. That concludes our oral arguments for today's case.